Hello and welcome to Asia Business First Podcast. I'm Julie Yu and my partner in crime, Adam Bhaktiya, is away for a long break. But to help me hold the fort once again is our deputy chief editor of digital news, David Bottomley. David, I think you should be asking for a fee.
I will be asking for a fee and a quite substantial fee. And you know, although I'm more than happy to keep Adam's seat warm for him, I do think questions need to be asked at the very highest level why he's allowed to go off ahead of the Chinese New Year long weekend. And I think he's gone on a trip on his private yacht, as far as I understand.
I'm sure.
And we're holding the fort here, keeping the podcast moving. But anyway, like Adam, lots of people have been skipping town. And people are also coming to town. We could also see plenty of tourists coming to Singapore during this holiday period.
That's right. Players in Singapore's tourism industry, like local tour agencies, shops and hotels, have been really gearing up for this time of the year. And I hear that they're making themselves China ready, so to speak, by teaching their staff Chinese etiquette, having Mandarin-speaking staff available to attend to the guests, and so on. So it's largely because of the changing travel trends by the Chinese. And we heard from this report earlier this week by Shanghai correspondent Valerie Tan. Now, she said that traditionally this holiday period would be about family reunification and mass migration to return home, but with urban middle class getting richer and millennials having stronger desire to spend, many Chinese are actually flocking to warmer vacation destinations like Singapore.
Yep, and it's estimated that as many as 6.5 million Chinese may travel overseas during the Lunar New Year holiday. That's an increase of about 6% from a year ago. And we're seeing that rise here in Singapore. The Singapore Tourism Board's latest year-end review report reflected that. The figures showed that China was Singapore's top source of tourists, not just during Chinese New Year, but for the whole of 2017, with visitors from China overtaking visitors from Indonesia. And overall, it's been a very good year for tourism in Singapore. Mm. Visitor arrivals and tourism receipts hit record highs for the second time in 2 years. And Singapore also saw record visitor arrivals from 7 countries. Besides China, Indonesia and India were the second and third main sources of tourists.
That's right, David. And joining us to discuss this and much, much more is Michael Chiam, is a senior tourism lecturer from Ngee Polytechnic, and Vijay Natarajan, property and REITs analyst from RHB Research Institute Singapore. Thank you both for joining us today.
It's our pleasure.
Hi. So Michael, let's start with you. Now, we just talked about Singapore riding that wave of Chinese tourists, but what else do you think contributed to these record-breaking numbers in 2017?
I think generally it's a result of hard work put in over the last many years, you know, by the tourism board as well as by the partners, both locals as well as overseas, particularly targeting at the second-tier cities.
Mm, hard work. How do you mean?
The tourism board has been targeting these second-tier cities in terms of the marketing campaign, introducing our local cuisine, local attractions to the people in the second-tier cities, and we are now paying off in that sense.
And what sort of things do visitors from China want to get out from a trip to Singapore? What are the attractions which are pulling those Chinese tourists here?
I think over the years, we have seen a changing trend. In the past, we used to have a lot of tourists that from China coming to Singapore in big tour groups. Increasingly, we find a lot of young, IT-savvy young people who actually plan their own trips using trip advisors, using internet. These are what we call the free and independent travelers, FIT. They normally would like to try something that is non-touristy, for example. You know, the way local people live, the food the local people eat. You could find them all over Singapore. Let's say, for example, you can find them in Little India, you can find them in Geylang Serai, trying the different type of cuisine. Even for that matter, a lot of Chinese love durian. You can find them in Geylang as well. Mm. You know, so these are the new trends of tourists that we find from mainland China are coming in. And they tend to spend a little bit longer time here. And because they are exploring things on their own, they tend to spend a little bit more than a typical tour group.
That's interesting because I think a little bit of the stereotypical view is that, number one, there's lots of good shopping here, not just for Chinese tourists, but for all tourists. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the casinos are a big draw for many visitors from Asia. But your sense is that there's a lot more to offer than these just flagship attractions.
Yeah, I think especially you look at Passion Make Possible campaign, the STB's launched last year.
This is where all that you're passionate about, all that drives you, is made possible.
I think we also want to share with tourists what we can offer as a lifestyle. You know, places you can eat, you can find unique food, places you can go based on your interests. I think this has given a different slant to the whole tourism offering that we have. Typically, in the past, we go to RWS, we go to Orchard Road, but if you are a repeat visitors, most probably you don't want to do that anymore. You want to find other things to do that create some level of excitement. So like Little Eatery in Chinatown would give you a special cuisine. Durian in Geylang, for example, will give you something different. Geylang Serai, Malay food, will give you a different offering. And Singapore generally is well connected by the train lines and so forth. Tourists basically can find their way around pretty easily.
I mean, Vijay, I'm sure I'm not the only one who've heard complaints about Singapore being less exhilarating compared to big cities for being too clean, too orderly, too rigid, for example. Do you agree with this? Have you heard of these complaints before?
I don't fully agree with it. I mean, there is always two sides to the coin. One side of the coin, people can say that cleanliness or too orderly is boring. But on the other side, people also like these kind of things. I mean, people want to visit a place where it is clean, where it is easily accessible. And one of the things which we should never forget, which Singapore offers, is safety. I mean, for countries like India and China, and even to many other visitors, safety is a very utmost priority. And everything is well connected here. I think generally people are quite friendly from whatever I have feel. So these are all the aspects, although some people can say it's more boring, it's a bit less exciting, it's very orderly, and there is always people who appreciate these salient factors.
Yeah, especially ladies, yeah. I think. I mean, they really look for the, how clean the city is, how easy it is to get around, shopping, food, and of course, safety.
Yeah, and I cannot say less about the sanitary facilities here, especially on when you compare it with the other city. I mean, it's definitely, if you go out of any MRT, you find the public transport, I mean, sanitary facilities. Even if I go to some countries like Europe, which is considered quite advanced, I have to find a while, especially for ladies, to find these kind of facilities, which I think is quite nice to have. You will only feel it when you miss it, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to delve too deeply into this issue, but when I was backpacking around Southeast Asia when I'd graduated from university, and I ran into some Scandinavian travelers, and we were talking about what makes a good travel experience, and one of them said that having access to good toilet facilities is the make or break for any destination. And I've kind of adopted that ethos quite strongly in that, you know, if you do have access to somewhere nice and clean and pleasant, it does make a big difference. And I guess that is one reason why Singapore is quite good. Although some people might say that some of the toilet facilities in some of the more hidden parts of the island are not quite up to scratch.
Yeah. I agree with Mr. Chia. It's more or less, STB has done a very good job in terms of marketing Singapore as it is. The other thing I also see is that it's a rise of low-cost carriers. I think you have a lot of low-cost carriers flying to Tier 2, Tier 1 cities, which has made flying possible. It's not just low-cost carriers. Thankfully, the oil prices fall has also resulted in ticket prices being much more cheaper. And these are all the factors which will come to mind when Tier 2, Tier 3 cities starting to travel, the affordability part. So I think you're also seeing a lot of wealthy, growing middle-class population in India as well as Chinese. And these are all millennials who have a different mindset when compared to the past. They want to travel, they want to see different places. And when they want to travel and when they want to see different places, what they look for is affordability, cleanliness, where I can get a different kind of experience. I think definitely Singapore fits the bill in this equation.
Okay, so Michael, how can Singapore maintain or even improve on these stellar numbers amid the stiff competition from other neighbors?
Okay, before I answer that question, maybe you could add to what Vijay has said. I think especially the Tier 2 city visitors, I think most probably that's the first time they leave their hometown. Oh. Of course, Singapore is an ideal choice because in terms of language, in terms of cleanliness, safety, I think it is a given. You know? So I think these people are generally comfortable in coming to Singapore. To answer your questions, I think we have to work harder. We have to continue to grow our Tier 2 cities because eventually these people will get richer. You know, they have the propensity to spend. And if they come to Singapore once, most probably they will come back again. If not, they will tell their friends that, you know, it's a worthwhile place to visit and we'll continue to grow this market. And at the same time, I think we are also looking for other cities to be included in these Tier 2 cities. And hopefully we'll grow the pie and we'll have more visitors coming to Singapore.
Michael, you touched on the whole concept of repeat visitors. Does Singapore have enough to offer somebody for a repeat visit? Once you've been here for a week, say, you've done the casinos, you've done Orchard Road, you've gone to Geylang, you've gone to Little India, haven't you really ticked off most of the key attractions?
I think there are a lot of hidden gems in Singapore. You know, for example, we have many historical sites. In the preservation of our historical site, I think we have at least 72 sites in Singapore, and I think not many Singaporeans knew about them. But the thing is that if we are able to interest tourists to these little nooks and corners and tell story, good story about where we come from, where we get to where we are now, what are the significance of these sites, then I think we open another gateway for a lot of different things. And the other thing is that we also have a lot of nature park, you know, but somehow Singaporeans may know about it, but not all tourists. So I think it's the way we promote nature park. For example, Pulau Ubin. You know, the Australians love Pulau Ubin. You know, there are many Australians go Pulau Ubin for hiking, cycling, and they like the nature part of it. I think Singapore, we could promote some part of this nature because people always have this stereotype thinking that, you know, Singapore is a very urbanized city. You know, we only have concrete buildings. But we have good nature park as well, you know, Sungai Buloh, a bit far for most tourists, but I mean, we could promote them as well, you know. So I think there are little pockets of gem here and there in Singapore. I think, first of all, locals need to know about them. Mm-hmm. And when locals knows about them, then I think they can promote them to friends. Especially, we also have another group of visitors to Singapore, people who can't visit their friends or their relatives. I think Singaporeans need to know about them so that, you know, we could promote these places to their friends and relatives, and hopefully the word of mouth, when they go back home, you know, they will spread these messages, and more of the free and independent travellers will come to Singapore and they will explore these places as well.
Let's go around the table and let's talk a little bit about what your favourite tourist attractions are, and if people are visiting from out of the country, what you recommend above and beyond the obvious attractions. So Vijay, what about you? What's your hidden gem for a Singapore visitor?
I think a lot of islands around Singapore, like St. John's Island, Kusu Island, these are not something which are very actively promoted. But I think this is something is a hidden gem to me. I mean, if you want to, you don't have to go to travel outside Singapore to see these gems. But some of these places offer a very unique perspective of nature, and it's quite well accessible too, I think. But it's not that much visited as it should be, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. St. John's is a fascinating place. You can just wander around there. And Michael, you might know more about the history of that place, but it used to be a leprosy centre or something like that?
It used to be Ellis Island, Singapore version.
Okay.
Where early immigrants come to Singapore. That is a holding place and they have to clear their health and the immigration procedures before they are allowed to land in Singapore.
So you can see some of the remains of some of the old buildings and structures there, and they've got some old villas, which I think you can rent out. I'm not too sure. But it is a fascinating place. But Vijay, as you say, it's not really prominent on most tourists' itineraries. Why do you think that is?
I think the focus has been a bit more of a cosmopolitan city, showcasing Singapore as a cosmopolitan city so far. That could also be one of the reasons why people say Singapore is less exciting, because this was not promoted. They didn't know the other side of Singapore, which has this kind of nature as well as a past history. But I think this will change. Eventually, I think the islands is also will be a part of a tourist campaign going forward, in my view. Coming back to your question, previous question, you asked what more a repeat visitor can see. Singapore has done a fantastic job in changing the mix of the tourist places, which you can see. If you come back 10 years back, you would not have seen the casinos. You would not have seen the gardens by the bay. Mm-hmm. And people who visit 5 years, 10 years before, and some of my relatives also who visit 10 years after, they say things have changed. Lots have changed. I mean, if you go to the Marina Bay district, if you go to the central district, things are keeping changing. And I think government is keeping in mind the fact that you have to change the mix. Looking forward, they also have this Mandai area. This is going to be rejuvenated completely by 2020. So I think, in a way, government is also looking forward to keep the mix changing. And that's something which I think is very forward-looking to me.
Okay, well, Vijay, you've endorsed St. John's and Kusu as somewhere that visitors to Singapore should consider going to. Michael, what's your hidden gem?
For me, I think first-time visitors will most probably be Garden by the Bay. And for repeat visitors, most probably areas around Fort Canning. I think Fort Canning is an interesting place. You know, I think there were plans to recurate the whole place for the 200 years celebration of Raffles Landing in Singapore. I think that is an interesting place because if you look at the history of Singapore, by and large, it started there. And if you are able to curate a story that is interesting enough to explain to visitors who we are, where we came from, then I think we have a lot of opportunity to actually bring visitors there to really understand a part of our history. I think in the past, that place has been well patronized, visited by locals rather than tourists. Other than the Battle Box there, by and large, I think most tourists have very little idea what significant has this place been to the Singapore history. So I hope that, you know, by building the momentum up, and it will eventually be a place that can be included in tourist itinerary as well.
Okay. Julie, we have to put the spotlight on you. Apart from the nearest whiskey bar, what would you recommend?
I'm still exploring, David. I've been here for 3.5 years, and nooks and corners over there. There's so many things that I discover. But I must say food. Culinary experience here is just phenomenal. You can find Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Thai, you name it, it's there. And yes, the obvious whiskey store.
And what's good about the food here is that you can get it in all ranges. So
right.
The cheap and cheerful or the very gourmet stuff. Mm-hmm. So whatever you want, almost any cuisine, you can have a pretty good experience.
Yeah, and David, you?
I like Labrador Park.
Not really.
Yeah, okay. That's an interesting place. It's got quite a lot of history there. There's still quite a lot of evidence of World War II gun emplacements, and it reeks of history and part of history which I'm very interested in. Oh. And it's just quite a nice, pleasant place to stroll around. And just going back to what you were saying, Michael, it's never very crowded. Mm. It doesn't seem to be on Singaporeans' radar for somewhere to go and visit. So I hope by speaking about it now, we're not going to see a whole flood of people turning up to explore it. I do like it very much.
Mm. And Michael, Singapore has been one of the world's top MICE destinations in Asia, but recently we saw a 5% dip in business travelers who were here for meetings, exhibitions, and conferences. Should we be concerned about that?
I think definitely we should be concerned, but at the same time, I think we have to work harder to see what we can do to bring in more visitors to Singapore.
Mm.
Having said that, I also want to qualify that some of these are actually beyond our control for that matter, you know, because a lot of meetings ride on economic cyclical wave. But I think if we work hard enough to bring big events, big conferences to Singapore, then I think we would most probably attract a lot of visitors.
Okay.
I mean, it's important to us because BD MICE visitors tend to spend a bit more than the typical leisure visitors.
So let's talk about other popular indulgences now, shopping and eating, my favorite things. The latest retail sales figures are released this week show that Singaporeans have been spending, but it wasn't evenly spread out across the board, was it, David?
No, it wasn't. If you look at the figures, retail sales in December rose 4.6% from a year ago. And that was primarily because of a jump in motor vehicle sales, which saw the highest year-on-year increase. If you exclude all that, retail sales actually went down 2.6% on a month-on-month basis. And on a year-on-year basis, retail sales were up by less than 1%. So, Vijay, are you surprised by this? The economy is in reasonable shape at the moment, but still the retail scene seems to be struggling.
I wouldn't say I'm totally surprised. I mean, if you ask from people on the ground, the economy, there is a bit of a disconnect between the economic figures as well as the sentiments, ground sentiments. I think it's basically a lag effect. I mean, even though if the economy has shown a lot of improvement, this has come from a manufacturing growth and a electronic segment growth. But if you look at from a people in terms of wage growth, and as if you talk to people in terms of job safety, there is still a bit of nervousness around the people. You have to keep in mind also that there is a changing consumer trend and changing consumer pattern, which you cannot forget. There is a lot of movement towards e-commerce, which could have caused this trend to continue also. So even though it was slightly lower than what I would have honestly expected, but I think it doesn't come out as a real surprise that you're seeing this kind of retail sales in Denmark.
There's been a lot of chat about whether the retail scene in Singapore has lost its mojo. It's been a narrative which has been discussed for years, it feels like. So Do you think there is some legitimacy to that, that setting aside the economic factors which you mentioned, setting aside the rise of e-commerce, do you think retail in Singapore is just a bit dull and bland?
I think it's not just Singapore. If you look at the way the world is, I mean, moving, US, you are seeing retail vacancy hitting rooftop. I mean, Toys R Us have closed down their stores in the US. I mean, it's a global trend. The trend has been set in motion because of the changing, as I said, the changing consumer pattern, as well as a movement towards e-commerce. From Singapore perspective, yes, there has been a bit of dip in terms of retail sales, but I think the retailers, if you talk to them, they are not sitting back and looking at this retail trend. They are also trying their best to change the mix of retail. They are also trying to understand how the consumer pattern has been changing over the period and trying to adapt to it. I would say it's a transition phase. The consumer pattern has been changing quite rapidly, and it needs some time for the retailers to adapt to the consumer pattern. I would expect them to emerge through this phase.
The one distinctive pattern that we see is among millennials, how they spend. I mean, they prefer to spend on personal experiences like travel, eating, and showing off pictures of them rather than buying stuff. I mean, and we saw a glimpse of that during the Valentine's Day yesterday. And I came across this very interesting survey by MasterCard where it showed that jetting off for a romantic trip and staycation, it saw a significant rise, and dinner dates accounted for about 70%. Of the spending. So it just shows how they're really going after those personal experience rather than objects and stuff. So how can retailers adapt to this sort of new mindset?
I think retailers are adapting to it. If you look at some of the changes which is happening in the retail space, many of the retailers are going to experiential mode. Like, for example, I knew Harvey Norman, for example, is creating a gaming zone where you can go there and create and see the feel, the effects of the gamings. And I think many of the retailers are also trying to impute virtual reality into it. It's not about just buying things. When you buy things, you want to feel how you would get it, especially for buying household items. You want to see how it fits into the house. And if you look at even malls like Funan, which is planning to be redeveloped, I think they are focusing a lot of experiential aspect into it. And this is a changing consumer pattern, which retailers have to adapt. I mean, what retailers have been trying to do is that bring the whole family in and make them stay. How can they do it? If you look at malls like City Square, what they are doing is basically have a play area or an indoor playground by which you are bringing the whole family out, spending more time. By spending more time, you eventually end up spending more on the shopping area also. And that's where I think the retailers have been focusing of late.
Let's talk about it from the visitor's perspective, Michael. Singapore has had a reputation of being a shopping paradise. To what extent do you think that still holds true? Does Singapore still hold its own in the shopping stakes?
I think the answer could be yes as well as no. Yes, because I think we have a lot of brands here. Visitors basically spoil for choice. No, because a lot of these brands are also found back home. So I think the notion of Singapore being a shopping paradise has been challenged, especially for the last few years. What I think is that we should evolve into things that can be found only in Singapore. You know, like, for example, local brands, local products. I think we have not really promoted that hard enough. You know, like, for example, you go to many cities around the world, you see crafts that is locally made, designer brands that are local. I think we are working towards that. Take, for example, if you go to Tokyo, you buy Tokyo banana. You go to Hokkaido, you buy Hokkaido biscuits. And, you know, there is a lot of potential in Singapore, but I think that we have not come to a point of harnessing this potential.
I know friends who buy chili crab paste before they go back to their country.
Right. So I think we have unique things that we can actually promote, you know, rather than the typical Singapore chocolates with the Malayan, the keychain, you know. I mean, there are many things that we could really pay attention to, you know. Like, for example, in the airport, I know pandan cake is actually one of those very sellable items among the Chinese visitors as well as the Hong Kong visitors. You know, can we creatively work around it? You know, make the cake maybe smaller, more portable. We have a lot of things to work on, if you think along those lines, you know.
But how realistic is it to really evolve and develop local brands when one of the complaints of the retail industry is that the mall operators charge extortionate rents and therefore they are gravitating towards the big international chains rather than the independent store, which might be the way to push local brands? So doesn't there need to be a rethink across the board of the whole retail model, that perhaps the mall operators should be more open to the idea of offering cut price rents for local brands? I mean, I don't know, is that even realistic? Would the malls even consider that, do you think, Vijay?
Retail landlords, in a way, they are also listed and they're also entitled to the shareholders and entitled to the shareholders in terms of rents and how they collect it. But I think this is an area, as you suggest, it's where a government can step in terms of if they really are serious about promoting some local products, considering where the rents are, the governments can step up in terms of providing some subsidies for these players who can come in. It would be hard to ask a retail landlord to go and just give them the free space because they themselves have purchased a land at high price. I mean, if you see from a perspective of a landlord who has purchased at a high price, it is not right to ask them to go and cut rents for these players.
Michael, do you think it's asking too much for the mall operators to be a little bit more friendly to local brands?
Well, I guess the mall operators could set aside X percentage of space to support the local enterprise. I think the other way is that when they revamp the whole Orchard Road, which are in the pipeline right now, I hope that they create space. You know, maybe a push cart kind of thing along the mall, along the walkways, for example, to help to promote some of our local products, local crafts, for example, just to lend a helping hand to help these people to start off. I think if we are able to do that and grow this local brand, then I think it's a viable solution in the long term to promote our local brand, our local products to tourists. And who knows, this brand may grow and become an international brand.
I think you hit the nail on the head earlier, Michael, when you compared Singapore to places like Tokyo and other regional destinations. Those destinations, in addition to having the big international brands, have got something a little bit more unique to offer. And that seems to me to be the thing which is missing in the Singapore retail scene at the moment.
Yes, I think more could be done to promote our local brands. Unfortunately, you look at the whole Orchard Road, almost 80-90% of the brands are international brands. H&M, Uniqlo. If you look at Uniqlo, H&M, you can find any city around Asia. So there is no reason for tourists, you know, to purchase this and lug them home. You could actually get it almost the same price back home. So I think that a rethinking of this whole local brand positioning has to come forth. I think STB and Spring Singapore are working towards that. And we have Orchard Design, I think Orchard Road. Yeah, that I think we are trying to promote our local brands.
Okay, well, we'll wait to see with great interest what happens on the retail front in Singapore. That's all we have time for this week. I'd really like to thank our guests for making it in on the eve of Chinese New Year. And they were Michael Cham, Senior Tourism Lecturer from Ngee Ann Polytechnic, and Vijay Natarajan, Property and REIT Analyst from RHB Research Institute, Singapore. Thank you, gentlemen.
And here's what's happening next week. We are expecting the release of the Singapore budget on Monday. We'll examine what it means for Singaporeans. And you can get all that and more, not just on this podcast, but every weekday from 9 a.m. Singapore, Hong Kong time on Asia Business First on Channel News Asia. And if you have any pressing questions or topics you'd like to cover, please get in touch with us. My Twitter is JulieUCNA, and you can reach me on Facebook as well. David?
Thanks for listening, and happy Chinese New Year. Goodbye.